Thank you for listening to KHSU, and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Wendy Butler, and I've got two interviews for you today. Later in the program, we'll hear from Humboldt State University Music Department faculty. The Welcome to Fall Semester concert is at 5 p.m. this Saturday, September 8th, in Fulkerson Recital Hall. First on Art Waves today, I've got Humans and Primes and the Conundrum of Memory. Redwood Curtain's latest is Jordan Harrison's Marjorie Prime, on stage this Thursday, September 6th through September 29th. My guests are director Caitlin Samuel and two of the actors, Christina Joris and Joan Shirley. Each of these performers plays the human character and the hologram of that character. Joan is Marjorie Lancaster, and her hologram, Marjorie Prime. Christina is Marjorie's daughter, Tess, and also Tess Prime. Joan begins the interview by responding to my question about the similarities and differences between her two selves.
There's a surprising likeness between the two of them, actually. I look a lot like myself in both of them. But the difference, I would say, is that we see Marjorie Lancaster a year from her death, her natural death.
You mean after she's already died or before she's going to die?
The first scene you see her in, she is 85, and the script says she dies at 86. So 1 year later, her hologram appears. So the hologram is simply a healthier version of her 85-year-old self, I would say, dressed like she is, hair done, a little cheerier, and her daughter reprimands the hologram for smiling too much because human Marjorie didn't smile that much.
Now, is the hologram smiling because the hologram is waiting to be fed?
The hologram is, that's not why the hologram is smiling. The entire purpose of these holograms is to bring comfort to the humans by providing them with stories from the memories that the humans have programmed them to retain. So she's smiling because the hologram believes that's her job, is to bring comfort to her former daughter.
Who programmed the Marjorie Prime?
My husband, John, who's played by Gary Summers, and I program Marjorie. He's done most of the work, and then I finally open up the box and try to play with her as a toy and figure out what I can do with her. So we have a conversation about who she was, which is as revelatory of who I am as it is who we were together.
So, do you have an honest conversation about who she was?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely honest. It's just, it's how do I remember her? And the aspects of her that I remember. So
there's also a deep family secret,
yes,
that only comes out later in the play. And Tess doesn't talk about it to Marjorie Prime, actually.
She doesn't talk about it to anybody.
That's right. And Marjorie herself, human Marjorie, in her last year can't remember what happened. And it concerns a dead son. Not like galactic sun, dead suns, but a
S-O-N, not S-U-N. S-U-N.
A teenage son who killed himself.
I want to be clear about this. Does Tess basically interview her elder, her living mother? Does Tess interview her living mother in order to extract information to program the hologram? No, never.
No, the purpose of the hologram Marjorie's hologram, that is the hologram of her late husband, is really there to provide her with comfort and memories so that he can help her remember, which, of course, in itself brings comfort. The hologram that Marjorie presents for Tess is, in theory, a way for Tess to say things to her that she wasn't able to say to her in life. But in order to be able to do that, you have to program your prime to know how to be. So, you know, she can't react as Marjorie would until we tell her who Marjorie was. And so in telling her who she was, it's as much about what I, as her daughter, observed of her and what I know of her and how we were together as it is, you know, who she was and what she looked like and what her history was. So
I'm going back to the hologram of the husband who is providing the memories.
Right.
So that's kind of tricky there. The husband is providing the memories for Marjorie, who has forgotten her memories.
Even trickier is that the hologram she has picked for her husband is him as a 30-year-old. So there's this very attractive young male hologram sitting there talking to Marjorie and feeding her back some stories that she's forgotten. And occasionally during the stories he's telling her, she remembers details of it and she gets very pleased and excited about that. But he doesn't have all the information either. So he's not telling her the whole
truth. Yeah, the primes only have the information that's been given to them through conversation. And everything does happen through a back and forth between the humans and the primes, which, as we've discovered, is part of the sort of the therapy, the comfort, because you have to talk it out with each prime. And that helps you as the human to talk to this entity. And whatever the last thing they're told is what they remember and how they shape the story, which is why one can choose or not to choose what to tell them if they don't want a family secret told, or if they prefer a different version of life, you can tell it that story, and then that story will be repeated back to you.
But that's a lie.
Perhaps.
So true.
Come to the show and decide how you feel about it. That's exactly right. Yeah. Is it a lie or is it not? Is it comfort? Is it not? Is it too much reliance on technology? Is it making us less human, or is it making us more human by interacting with technology in a different way, in a way that might point out what is the quintessential humanness of humans or not? Or, you know, are we just leaning on something that's not real?
Holograms want to be more human.
They do.
Say that. That's their goal. They like us. We're unpredictable.
Yeah, they do. Their sort of goal and parameters is to try and be more human, which is also, too, why watching, they'll pick up mannerisms, they'll pick up speech patterns and all of those sorts of things, the more that they're talking.
And going into this, Caitlin, as director, did you have a certain vision for how you wanted this stories told by the characters?
Yeah, through them, through their lenses. It's easy to get sort of distracted by the big concepts, which are all a part of the play and are very important. Yeah, and it's a lot to get through intellectually. But really, the story is still told through the lens of a family having a hard time, a family caretaking an older, you know, relative. The matriarch of the family is on her way out. I think that's hugely relatable and accessible, and we've all had experiences of that. And I think it's important, at least for me, it was very important to remember that's where the story starts and stops, is with them. And all of this other stuff is integrated in and out. And and I really believe in collaboration. And I think as a director, I could sit alone and plan out every second and still do. But it's really about being in the room with these actors who are brilliantly talented and seeing what they bring to the table and what their experiences lend and see how that blends all together. So how we are telling the story, not just me alone.
It's an acting challenge, but there's a lot of subtlety to play with. How much does the prime move when it makes a mistake, which happens frequently when it's being initially programmed? In Marjorie's scene with Tess, is trying to tell her things about herself, and Marjorie keeps making these little mistakes and apologizing, and it becomes a sort of a way, how do I reveal through my body language that I'm a prime, not a human, my reactions, I try to take my eyes off my daughter as little as possible, since it's all about observing human behavior in order to learn. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's fun, actually, to try to distance myself from my humanity ever so briefly.
Yeah. And how much do you, how much does the prime react, and what are they reacting to? Because the humans don't, you know, if you push a button on a human, they react in a way that is informed by everything that's happened before. The prime, it's always sort of new. And there's a certain sense of, did I get it right?
and they don't know if they're lying. Don't I don't know if she's lying to me.
Right.
I only know what she's telling me or what my her husband has told me about my former self.
Right.
Actors Joan Shirley and Christina Joris, and director Caitlin Samuel, Redwood Curtain's Marjorie Prime, this Thursday, September 6th through Saturday, September 29th. Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m. Sunday matinees on September 16th and 23rd at 2 p.m. Friday Focus is September 14th. Arrive at 7:15 p.m. to hear from director and or designers, and stay after the show to meet the actors for more discussion. And Redwood Curtain is located at 220 First Street, Eureka. For tickets and information, you can phone 707-443-7688 or visit redwoodcurtain.com. I'm Wendy Butler, and you're listening to KHSU and to Art Waves. The HSU Music Faculty presents its Welcome to the Fall Semester Concert this Saturday, September 8th at 5 p.m. in Fulkerson Recital Hall. It will showcase the range and variety of music composed and performed by music faculty here on campus. This is the first Faculty Artist Series concert of the new academic year. And I've got three faculty participants in the studio. Cindy Moyer, who is also chair of the music department. Here also are Dan Aldag and Brian Post, who begins the interview. While not performing in this particular concert, Brian has composed a piece of music for it.
I've titled it Prairie Creek Trails. And it is an electroacoustic composition for randomly altered audio samples, randomly altered video, and solo cello.
I'm fascinated by that. Randomly altered.
Yes.
You're the first person that I think I can think of that I've had on here that is called an instrument or a method of playing an instrument that randomly altered. Please explain what that means.
Okay. For this piece, I took a hike, a number of hikes out of Prairie Creek Trails, and I recorded the creek in different places. I recorded rain on the redwoods. I got bat calls from Joe Suzak in biology of Northern California bats. I got a recording from someone who builds audio devices, underwater audio devices, and works on the North Coast. So from him, I got a gray whale sound for this. And I also got some sounds of elk bugling in the Prairie Creek Park. And so I put all these sounds. And on top of that, I've recorded the cellist Garrick Woods playing different special techniques on the cello, just to create more ambient sounds. And then I feed all these sounds into the computer, which takes each one of those recorded sounds and will alter it in ways that are subtle but always different. And it plays the sounds back at different times and will never really allow this piece to sound the same twice. And for that soundscape that's constantly morphing, changing with sounds of the ocean, not the ocean, but the creek and bats and things, I've written a written out piece of music for the cellist Garrick Woods to play as well along with it. And it's written in a very free style so he can react to the sounds he's hearing at the time that the computer is generating. And one day walking in Prairie Creek, I videotaped different parts of Prairie Creek Trail, and I am also incorporating those into the performance. So there'll be two videos of Prairie Creek playing simultaneously, being altered randomly by the computer as well as the sounds. And also the cellist at one point will be able to interact with the video and play things that will change the video.
The cellist had no time. The cellist was not able to rehearse. Cannot rehearse with this computer because this computer will do what it does.
Exactly. He has rehearsed with it some. We rehearsed today, and partly the trick today was, well, is a computer listening to you as you play and making those changes to the video on the screen. And I actually told the computer to do it correctly, and it does now very nicely. And he's fine with it. He said, now, today we were rehearsing. And he said, now, it's not recording me and playing back, right? I said, no. He says, because it's so uncanny. Sometimes it sounds just like me, what I've just done. And so, you know, there's this conversation going on that you don't know where it's going to go as you play. He's going to just be, you know, interacting with a computer and have to, you know, take what he gets.
Now, that's interesting. But here at Humboldt State University, Brian, you don't teach computer technology, you teach music.
Yes, and part of my field is composition, a major part, and yeah. Digital audio technology has become a primary force in modern music. And so I experiment with digital audio technology, and I have an electronic music class that I teach. And in my composition studio, I require all of my students to participate in electroacoustic performances at each recital.
And so, Dan, is your performance at the concert, is it following the composition that Brian has created?
Not directly. We're closing the concert. I'm playing with the brass quintet that I'm a part of, the North Coast Brass Ensemble, and we're the last group on the concert. I think Brian's piece is first on the second half. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so the North Coast Brass Ensemble is made up of Chris Cox and Tom Hyde on trumpet, Ronnie Glick on horn, myself on trombone, and Fred Tempus, who also teaches in the music department, on tuba. And we're playing three jazz pieces by three of the greatest jazz composers from different eras of jazz's history, Jelly Roll Morton, Charles Mingus, and Duke Ellington, the first two of which I arranged for the quintet to play. The Jelly Roll Morton piece is called Mamanita, dedicated to the woman who apparently was the great love of his life, a woman named Anita Gonzalez. The second piece is by Charles Mingus called Self-Portrait in Three Colors. And then we're closing with a Luther Henderson arrangement of Duke Ellington's Cottontail.
How does that work, arranging? You know, because that's words often used. People say right. So-and-so arranged. What does that involve doing? Yeah.
Well, in the case of the Jelly Roll Morton piece, he wrote that as a solo piano piece and recorded it that way. And I got a written transcription of what he had played. And then basically I'm assigning the notes that were originally played on the piano to the various brass instruments. In the case of the Charles Mingus piece, Self-Portrait in Three Colors, that was originally recorded by a small group that consisted of two or three saxes, trombone, piano, bass, and drums, and kind of reassigning the melodic lines played by the horns and then coming up with similar types of accompaniment to what the piano, bass, and drums would do, but, you know, with the constraints of doing it with the instruments of the brass quintet.
It's interesting to me, and I didn't plan this when I put the program order together, but it is interesting that the second half will begin and end with little bits of improvisation. Very yeah. different kinds,
right.
but some of that at the beginning and the end.
And you've always exclusively played the trombone?
Pretty much, yeah. I play enough piano to get through the piano competency test that I had to take as an undergrad, and I can play some euphonium, enough to teach it occasionally, but trombone is my primary instrument.
Why?
Why is the trombone my primary instrument?
Why trombone?
Yeah, because when I was 10, my two older brothers told me that's what I was going to play.
Okay.
One of them played trumpet, one of them played French horn, and they said we need a trombone to complete the brass trio. So you're playing trombone.
So you played in a trio with your brothers?
Just twice, because you can imagine three brothers trying to play in a group together. Yeah.
You don't have any recordings of it?
No, thankfully, no.
Oh. Dan Aldag. Also here, our fellow HSU music faculty, Brian Post, and Cindy Moyer. The topic is this Saturday's Welcome to the Fall Semester Concert by HSU Music Faculty. I'm Wendy Butler, and this is Art Waves on KHSU. And Cindy, you're also performing on the concert. What are you performing? Who are you performing with, and what instrument are you performing on?
So I'm a violinist, and I'm playing with the Arcata Bay String Quartet, which is me and Karen Davey playing violin, Sherry Hansen playing viola, and Garrick Woods playing cello. We are doing a slow movement, really beautiful, interesting, really interesting harmonies in this piece of a Haydn string quartet. That'll be the only slow thing on the concert, so it's going to be very different from everything else. And we are also being joined by John Chernoff to do the scherzo movement of the Dvorak Piano Quintet, which is very fast and very much like a Czech dance. It's titled actually a furiant, not a scherzo, and that is some kind of Czech dance, and that's about as much as I know about what a furiant is.
And so no improvisation in
no improvisation in any of our stuff. Just perhaps improvisation as the spirit moves us for how we want to express the music, but we intend, hopefully, to play the notes that the composers wrote.
What attracted you to violin?
So my mother was a violin teacher, and when I was six, she went away to a workshop on how to teach Suzuki violin when that was a pretty brand new thing in America, and came home all fired up to try it out, and there I was, the perfect guinea pig. So I became a violinist. Like Dan, my family is all musicians. My sister's a cellist, my father's an organist, and we did manage to do a fair amount of playing without killing each other, perhaps because there were parents to provide some interference.
Well, do you have any recordings of you playing with your family?
Not that I'm aware of. There probably are some. I think there are probably some recordings of me as a very young child playing, which might have a cute factor, but probably isn't all that musically satisfying.
We're starting a brand new school year. What classes are you teaching?
So I'm teaching violin and viola lessons, as well as it's really the third semester of music theory that students take. So the concert connects very nicely to the teaching. Obviously, for all the students who are taking lessons, just about every instrument that students study at HSU is represented in this concert. So it's a chance for them to hear a model of what they're trying to achieve. And for the students in my theory class, it's a chance to hear some other music and hear some of what we've been studying out in real life.
And your approach as a teacher, the students you have, some are going to be more well-versed in the music. You're going to have students who are new as well. And so how do you relax them, you know, in the beginning of a semester?
I try to remind them that they are all entirely capable of doing what we're asking them to do, and that my job is to support them in making them able to do that, but that they can do this. And I very much believe that they all can.
And Brian, how about you? Well, first of all, tell me again, I don't even know if you told me before, we were talking about computers. What's your instrument?
I play piano.
You're a pianist?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you teach, what do you teach?
I teach music theory, so usually right. Music theory 1 and 4, and Cindy teaches 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. And then I also teach various composition classes that'll include contemporary composition, film scoring, electronic music, big band arranging, And I think that's everything. And then private composition lessons. Oh, and counterpoint.
Why piano?
I played a little trumpet growing up, and I chipped my teeth in about sixth grade, and I got some caps on there. And then the caps fell off, and I was still playing the trumpet. My embouchure was good. And then they put more caps on, and my embouchure just didn't work anymore. And I was about 17 or 18, and I was studying some jazz improv with a man, Mark Levine, who was a pianist and played val trombone at the time. And I was over at his house taking a lesson, and the phone rang, and he came back after talking. That guy's trying to get me to write an easy jazz piano book. I wish he'd stop calling me. And I said, well, you have an easy jazz piano method? And he said, yeah. I said, well, show it to me. And he did. He first said I didn't know enough, but I said, what do I need to know? And he tested me, and I answered all the questions right. So he said, I have to show you, you know, I guess I have to teach it to you. And from that day, I became a pianist. That was my first piano lesson, was studying jazz piano. And then I practiced lots and lots and auditioned into a piano performance program at the classical level and got my bachelor's in piano performance.
And Dan, what are you teaching this year?
I teach trombone lessons. I lead all the jazz groups, and I teach a general education course in the history of rock and roll.
And then, and I didn't ask Brian this yet, but what do you tell your students beginning? You have students of all levels, of all expectations. How do you relax them, get them ready for the year?
Well, I usually say something like, relax or I'll kill you. And,
all right.
Always effective.
Yeah. I think... you know, humor can be very effective in a situation where you're trying to get people to relax. And I think, you know, just demonstrating that I'm on their side, you know, and that we're doing this together, you know, particularly with the ensembles that I teach, you know, that it's a process that we're all engaged in. And, you know, we're all trying to get from point A to point B.
And Brian, mm-hmm. is humor a part of what you do?
Very much. This week I was teaching triads and tonality in Theory 1, and those are chords that can be built on a major scale. If you play a major scale and then harmonize that scale with three notes at a time called triads, that's what composers use, that approach, to create their chord progressions. And certain chords say, I don't care where I go. And other chords say, I'd like to go to this chord over here. And other chords say, you need to go back to the first chord right now. And so I tell them a story, you know, the one chord, that's like mom and dad home, everything's good. And then you got the middle median chord. That's kind of like the middle brother or sister. You get to that five chord and add the seventh. That's the two-year-old. You're at the restaurant having a nice meal, and that chord comes in and says, we got to go home now, because it's crying and it's really fussy. And the only resolution is to take it home or feed it or whatever.
Brian Post. Humor, a vital component of teaching. Also here have been Dan Aldag and Cindy Moyer. The occasion, HSU music faculty present a Welcome to the Fall Semester concert this Saturday, September 8th at 5 p.m. at Fulkerson Recital Hall. For tickets, you can phone Center Arts at 707-826-3928. And for more information, you can visit humboldt.edu, or you can phone the music department at 826-3531. And that's Art Waves. Join me for the next regular broadcast Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. Listen anytime online at khsu.org. You can download podcasts of the program from iTunes. I'm Wendy Butler. Until next time, thanks for listening.